It's Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Obama, speaking Sunday in Germany, acknowledged there is strong opposition to a free trade agreement with the U.S., in part due to the perception such deals cost jobs. He acknowledged some in Europe oppose the deal because they're unsettled by globalization, but predicted it would be reached before he leaves office in January, while also admitting it will take longer to ratify.
The benefits oftentimes are diffuse, whereas a particular plant or business that feels it's been hurt by outside competition feels it very acutely. But if you look at the benefits to the United States or to Germany of free trade around the world, it is indisputable that it has made our economy stronger. It has made sure that our businesses are the most competitive in the world. And as you see other markets like China beginning to develop, we've got to make sure that our businesses can compete there.
Opponents of the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership have been critical of what they perceive as opaque negotiations, carried out away from public scrutiny, and fear the pact will hand too much power to big multinationals at the expense of consumers and workers. The U.S. Sunday expressed disappointment by what it calls the continued failure of South Sudan's government and rebels to form a transitional government of national unity, as spelled out in last August's peace agreement. Saturday, the Juba government denied landing rights to the plane carrying rebel leader Riek Machar, failing to meet a deadline set by the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission. The statement condemned what it called the obstruction by rebels who have been demanding they bring in more forces and more heavy weapons than was agreed to last year. This is VOA News. The UN Security Council Sunday condemned North Korea for its submarine-launched ballistic missile test on Saturday, calling it another serious violation of existing UN resolutions. Bruce Bennett, a RAND Corporation Korea analyst, said the pace of North Korea's banned nuclear missile program testing is quickening.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, now this is at least their fourth and perhaps their fifth test, according to what's been said in the media today, all in less than a year. That's really pretty progressive for the North Koreans. They're clearly trying to make some points before their May Party Congress that's only a few weeks out.
Pyongyang said the latest test proved the reliability of its submerged launching system, but South Korea called it a failure, noting the missile traveled just 30 kilometers before falling back into the sea. U.S. officials traveling with President Obama Sunday said he plans to send another 250 U.S. military personnel to Syria to help opposition fighters battle the Islamic State. The announcement expected Monday as Mr. Obama sits down with European heads of state to discuss Syria, among other matters. Stephen Zunis, a Mideast analyst at the University of San Francisco, said there's been a momentum shift against Islamic State in both Syria and Iraq.
The problem, though, is that if there are indeed population centers where ISIS is driven out, what replaces them? Especially on the Iraqi side, there are concerns that given the misrule and the tensions between the Shia-dominated government and the Sunni-populated cities in that area, returning to the unpopular governance that made possible the opening for ISIS would mean that ISIS could very well make a comeback.
In a BBC interview, Mr. Obama said the U.S.-led coalition will continue airstrikes against IS targets in places like Raqqa and Mosul to try to, quote, isolate and lock down those portions of the country that are sending foreign fighters to Europe. Austria's anti-immigration far-right Freedom Party scored its best electoral win, taking more than 30% of the vote in the country's first-round presidential contest, and will face a more pro-immigrant Greens Party opponent in next month's runoff, May 22nd. Both the center-left Social Democrats and Conservative People's Party have exchanged the ceremonial post since 1951. The post of president are out of the competition. In Serbia, pro-Western Prime Minister Aleksandar Vučić Sunday won a resounding victory in his pursuit of membership in the European Union. He secured another 4 years in power, his conservative Progressive Party taking a majority in parliament. Yemeni troops backed by Saudi-led airstrikes advanced into the southern port city of Mukalla Sunday, a stronghold of the al-Qaeda in Arabian Peninsula militant group. The effort comes as peace talks got underway last week in Kuwait in an effort to end a conflict that's taken over 6,000 lives. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, April 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ugandans are urged to move past the February 18 disputed election and join the process of rebuilding the nation.
Ugandans are united. Elections are over, and we are back to business of building Uganda and transforming it from a backward state to a modern and prosperous state.
Ruhakana Rugunda is Uganda's prime minister. Rights groups and Gambian diaspora demand the release of opposition members in the Gambia. Amnesty International accuses Nigeria's army of mass killings. And Sudan welcomes Darfur referendum results.
Those who are pro the status quo was about 97.7. So this is an overwhelming majority from the Darfurian people. They all want the state condition as it is now.
Ahmed Bilal, Sudan's information minister. The U.S. says Zimbabwe is top priority for food aid and increased risk of premature death on the rise due to increase in global diabetes. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ugandan Prime Minister Ruhakana Rugunda says most Ugandans have put the February 18 presidential election in their rear view mirror and resumed the task of transforming the country into a modern, prosperous nation. His comments came as the European Union Observer Mission recently released its final report on the February 18 election, saying, among other issues, the Electoral Commission lacks independence and transparency. Some Ugandans believe opposition leader Kizza Besigye is still not able to walk freely in the capital, Kampala, more than 2 months after the election. Rugunda says Dr. Besigye, like any other Ugandan citizen, is free to go wherever he wants to go if he obeys the law. Rugunda called on Dr. Besigye and his supporters to join the process of rebuilding Uganda.
The country is not divided. Uganda held peaceful elections on 18th of February. Ugandans overwhelmingly voted for the National Resistance Movement, and Ugandans voted for Yoweri Kaguta Museveni for president with a vote of 60%. So Ugandans are united, elections are over, and we are back to business of building Uganda and transforming it from a backward state to a modern and prosperous state that is going to be in middle class, middle country incomes.
If that is the case, then, Mr. Prime Minister, why is it that Dr. Besigye of the Forum for Democratic Change cannot walk freely in the capital, Kampala?
Dr. Kizza Besigye, like any other Ugandan, is a free man. But like any other Ugandan, he has been on a number of occasions caught not respecting the law, and the law has taken its course. We nevertheless believe that the excitement of elections is now gone. The country is settling down to development and modernization and transformation, and we expect that Kizza Besigye and his supporters will be part of this process of transforming Uganda.
Mr. Prime Minister, what would you say to some Ugandans in the diaspora who are calling, say, for sanctions, including travel ban against your government?
Well, Ugandans are at liberty to express their views in any way, in any manner they would want. But ultimately, what matters is that Uganda is governed by its constitution, by the laws of the land, and by the will of the people. But Ugandans are at liberty to express their views, contradictory as they may be, in agreement or disagreement with the government. That is their fundamental right.
The European Union Observer Mission to the February 18 election issued its final report. It says that the elections were held amid political challenges that left the process short of key democracy standards. Among them, they cited, for example, the independence and transparency in the Electoral Commission. What's your comment?
They expressed their views. They are entitled to their views and opinions. So at an appropriate time, some of their views will be considered. Some may be taken on by government. Others will be rejected. So the prerogative is on the people of Uganda to determine the destiny of their country.
Ruhakana Rugunda is Uganda's prime minister. He was speaking with me from New York City. The government of Sudan is welcoming the results of this month's referendum in the country's war-torn Darfur region. The Darfur Electoral Commission said about 98% of the 3.2 million eligible voters decided to keep the current five-state system and not to unite into a single autonomous region. Sudan Information Minister Ahmed Bilal says the results reflect the wishes of the people of Darfur. Now, he says, Sudan and Darfur can move forward with peace, stability, and development in the region.
You know that the registration for the referendum was very high, more than those who registered for the last election last year, about 3.5 million. Out of these, 93%, they have given out their votes. Out of these, those who are pro the status quo was about 97.7. So this is an overwhelming majority from the Darfurian people. They only want the state's condition as it is now. They don't want the region system.
The results as the status quo benefits your government.
In fact, actually, the whole Sudan is within this context. The whole Sudan is, the system is now, it will be unique. The problem it will be is they choose the region system. That means either we govern Sudan by the two systems, one system with the region and the others with the state system. But now this is actually the whole country will be unified and the system will be only one system. This is a federal system on three levels. The federal one and then the states and then the locals.
Mr. Minister, as you know that some of the major rebel organizations and opposition groups boycotted this referendum. In fact, some people in the international community criticized your government for pushing through this referendum.
You know something, this actually, if we didn't do the referendum in the time which we agreed about, the same people and even the rebels and the opposition will say, no, the government does not respect what they signed for, and they will not go for the referendum, and we want the referendum, and a lot of cries will be out for that. And as now we did it, and this is the wish and the will of the people in Darfur, now they are saying the opposite. Why it is on the first time, why not? I'm telling you one something. We will not stop life for the sake of very few people who want only war, who want only instability for Sudan. Want only not development unless things come on their own choice. And this will not happen. So now Darfur is free totally of rebel movements. Therefore, now they want development. And the total resources which are allocated for security will now go for development. And we have still some problems between the tribes and tension between tribes and these things. So we will go forward for complete stability, peace, and development in Darfur.
Ahmed Bilal, Sudan's information minister, he was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. Today's Monday, April 25th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. In Dakar, Senegal, rights activists and members of the Gambian diaspora marched on Friday to demand the unconditional release of dozens of opposition members arrested in Gambia 1 week ago. The opposition says at least three of its members were killed in detention. Alpha Diallo has more from Dakar.
Hundreds of marchers in downtown Dakar chanted Defantoy, enough is enough. The march is a sort of solidarity with dozens of opposition members detained for over a week in Gambia. They were arrested during a protest calling for electoral reform. The government says the demonstration was unauthorized. The UDP opposition party says three of its members were tortured to death in custody. The High Court charged 37 others Thursday for participating in an unlawful demonstration. But Gambians' rights activists say about 80 people were arrested in all, and they are still searching for information about those who did not appear in court Thursday. Siddharth Job, a former Gambian government minister, says the world can no longer ignore the worsening human rights situation in Gambia.
The ECOWAS and the African Union will realize that the only thing to do in order to help the Gambians is to see to it that Yahya Jammeh is no more a part of the political atmosphere of the Gambia.
Gambia is surrounded on three sides by Senegal. President Yahya Jammeh has been in power since 1994. A coup attempt by former military officers last year failed. In 2015, Amnesty International condemned what it called iron-fisted repression by Jammeh's government and widespread rights violation. Amnesty Senegal director Sidi Gassama says free and fair election must be held.
Senegalese people and the Senegalese and the Gambian people are just one people in two different states. And we will not stand and let him kill our brother in the Gambia. We will not accept that. We will not accept any further brutality against peaceful demonstrators in the country.
Many Gambian journalists and activists live in exile in Dakar. Killer Ace, a young Gambian hip-hop musician, says they are ready to return to Gambia.
Absolutely, 100%. I mean, it's only right. If people on the ground are ready, we're definitely going to come and join them because this is everybody's fight.
Killer Ace took the microphone at the march. Alpha Jallo for VOA News, Dakar.
Amnesty International says hundreds of people were killed by the Nigerian military in a clash with a Shiite Muslim sect in the northern city of Zaria in December. The release of the report Friday comes as the government filed charges that carried the death penalty against hundreds of the group's surviving members. Chris Stein reports.
In December, residents of the Kaduna suburb Mondo noticed a massive hole dug in a remote part of their local cemetery. It was then filled almost as quickly as it had been dug. What they only found out later was that it was full of bodies. A Kaduna state official told VOA that inside the mass grave were the corpses of 347 people killed in a clash between the military and the Islamic Movement of Nigeria, a Shiite sect based in Zaria. Amnesty International's senior crisis response advisor, Donatella Rivera, says what took place there was a massacre. A report from the rights group says soldiers shot children in the head and set a building full of wounded people on fire, then tried to cover it all up. In addition to those buried in the mass grave, the Shiite group says a further 350 of their members remain missing.
The Nigerian military went to extraordinary efforts to cover up their crime, to destroy the evidence, and this is very striking.
The military says soldiers fought back after members of the sect tried to assassinate the chief of army staff as he passed through Zaria. Spokesmen for the military declined to comment on Amnesty's findings. Rivera says both the military and Kaduna State are complicit in covering up the deaths of hundreds of people. One state official says he was merely doing his job. Namadi Musa, an advisor to the government on religious matters, told VOA that Kaduna's governor asked him a day after the clash to travel to Zaria and ensure that 347 corpses released by the military were given a proper burial.
I followed specific instruction. Count the number, make sure they are buried in a dignified way, and know where they are buried.
A state commission of inquiry is investigating the incident. State officials this week filed charges against a group of 50 people arrested after the clash. A lawyer for the group, Festus Okoye, says he expects a total of 265 people to be arraigned in the coming weeks. Of those, 255 will face charges of culpable homicide, which carries the death penalty. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
The United States Agency for International Development says Zimbabwe is a top priority for Washington in the provision of food aid amid reports of donor fatigue. Jason Taylor, chief of the Office of Humanitarian Assistance and Resilience at USAID Zimbabwe, says indications are that the food situation will worsen in the country as most crops have failed this season.
We made our most recent $20 million contribution in response to a terrible drought year in southern Africa in general and Zimbabwe in particular, which we expect will result in very low levels of crop production here in Zimbabwe and near total write-offs in certain areas, in the hardest hit areas of the south. And we decided to make this contribution because we realized that humanitarian assistance would need to be ongoing throughout the coming months following the harvest, particularly for those people who wouldn't have a harvest.
This 20 million, it's given to the people in what form? Do you give them money or food?
This particular contribution is for the World Food Program, and it's going to be for in-kind food. We, in the past year, have done both food and cash for beneficiaries, depending on market conditions. And because we know that the World Food Program is going to be operating in the hardest hit areas, this particular contribution will be in food.
In your statement, we also noted that there is this problem of malnutrition. What are you doing about this?
Yeah, you're right. Malnutrition rates are rising in Zimbabwe. They're still low compared to other areas of the world, but they are on the rise, and so we are worried about the trajectory. Part of our efforts to address that is giving this sort of contribution, because when you're feeding a family, you're going to free up resources for the youngest members. But that said, it's not always going to be enough. We have multi-year development programs that provide food assistance for families and are specifically structured to reduce malnutrition and reduce stunting.
Lastly, has it been easy to raise money?
It can be extremely difficult. Despite the challenges of trying to contextualize your crisis in a landscape of many competing crises, I think we've been fortunate. USAID has really done a good job on the Washington level to understand the nuances and provide assistance where it's been needed most. And so we've seen in Zimbabwe a marked increase in the level of humanitarian assistance. So that shows that people in Washington are definitely paying attention, and we're all pushing in the same direction.
That was Jason Taylor, Chief of the Office of Humanitarian Assistance and Resilience at UCS Zimbabwe. He was speaking with Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe program. The World Health Organization says 422 million adults are living with diabetes, a fourfold increase over 1980 figures. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The release of this report is meant as a call to global action to halt the rise of type 2 diabetes, which is killing 1.5 million people a year. The World Health Organization estimates 43% of these deaths occur prematurely before the age of 70. The UN agency says diabetes is no longer a disease of the wealthy. Most cases now are found in middle and low income countries. The WHO says the highest rates are in the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and the Western Pacific. The WHO report says the dramatic rise of this deadly disease is largely due to the increasing number of overweight and obese people. It reports more than 1 in 3 adults is overweight and more than 1 in 10 is obese. Etienne Krug is the director of WHO's Department for Management of Noncommunicable Diseases. He says diabetics will suffer complications from the disease if it is not detected in a timely manner and treated.
People with diabetes have a 2 to 3 times higher risk of cardiovascular disease. They have a 10 to 20 times higher risk of lower limb amputation. Diabetes is an important cause of blindness through diabetic retinopathy and an important cause of end-stage renal disease.
Krug tells VOA the economic cost of diabetes can be catastrophic for both the individual and society. He notes that monthly insulin treatment, which is a question of life and death for many patients, can be expensive.
We know that just the annual direct medical costs exceed $827 billion every year. So it's a very, very vast, large number. And that is not taking into account many other types of costs, such as lost productivity, etc., etc.
The UN agency says adopting a healthy lifestyle can prevent the majority of cases. The report's recommendations include eating healthier, engaging in more physical activity, and avoiding excessive weight gain. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's coming up at 25 minutes past the hour. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. Kenyan defending champion Eliud Kipchoge carried the day in convincing style at the London Marathon in the British capital on Sunday. Kipchoge prevailed in a lifetime best of 2 hours, 3 minutes and 5 seconds. He improves his personal best by 55 seconds, but missed the world record by a mere 8 seconds. Fellow Kenyan Stanley Biwott was runner-up in a lifetime best of 2 hours, 3 minutes and 51 seconds, while Ethiopian Kenenisa Bekele was third in 2 hours, 6 minutes and 36 seconds. Meanwhile, Kenyan Jemima Sumgong triumphed in the women's race in 2 hours, 22 minutes and 58 seconds. She edged Ethiopian defending champion Tigist Tufa by 5 seconds, while Kenyan Florence Kiplagat was third in 2 hours, 23 minutes and 39 seconds. In football, Morocco pipped Egypt 3-2 to win the Africa Futsal Cup of Nations here in Johannesburg, South Africa on Sunday. Mozambique squeezed a slender 2-1 win over Zambia in a post-match penalty shootout in the bronze medal playoff after they tied 5-all at the end of open play. Mozambique also clinched the tournament's fair play award, while Mozambique's Ricardo Linos Mendes Mwindane was the tournament's top scorer with 10 goals. Consequently, Morocco, Egypt and Mozambique will represent Africa at the FIFA Futsal World Cup in Colombia in September. Meanwhile, hosts Mauritania beat Algeria 2-0 in the return leg of the Africa Under-20 Championship qualifying knockout on Sunday. Mauritania eliminate Algeria on a 3-2 aggregate. Guinea and Liberia drew a 1-1. Guinea advanced on a 3-1 aggregate. Early on Saturday, Gambia dismissed Sierra Leone 2-0 to progress on a 4-0 aggregate. Namibia eliminated Swaziland 4-2 on aggregate. Tunisia dismissed Niger 4-1 on aggregate. Uganda edged Rwanda 3-2 on aggregate. Zimbabwe pipped Botswana 2-1 on aggregate, and Ethiopia eliminated Somalia 4-1 on aggregate. Although Mauritius and Mozambique tied 2-2 on aggregate, Mauritius go ahead courtesy of the away goal rule. Finally, the draws for the Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Cup take place in Windhoek, Namibia today, Monday. Teams set for the draws include Angola, Botswana, Lesotho, Madagascar, Malawi, Mauritius, Mozambique, Seychelles, South Africa, Swaziland, Zambia, Zimbabwe, guest side the Democratic Republic of Congo, along with the defending champions and hosts Namibia. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Monday morning, April 25th.
The diversion of fuel to neighboring countries, creating untold hardship on the citizenry, is a clear indication that some security men in Nigeria are corrupt and not faithful to their services. A drastic measure should therefore be taken against the perpetrators. Ashikusha from Obanuku in Ubudu, Katin Ranch, crossover to Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Equatorial Guinea President Teodoro Obiang, Africa's longest-serving leader and world's longest-serving non-royal head of state, was expected to dominate Sunday's election for a new term that could take his reign past the four-decade mark. Obiang, 73, assumed power in the oil-producing Central African nation following a military coup in 1979, and the government has promised a successful vote with maximal transparency. And that's it for this Monday, April 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, report with Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Mark Oman, along with all of our engineers. I'm James Butty in Washington saying have a lovely day.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Modou discusses World Immunization Week, the progress made on the vaccine front and the remaining challenges. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Else chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.